WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
We're going to broadcast this sometime early next week. I'm not going to introduce you now. I'm going to do that live, and I'm going to play the theme live when we play the interview.
We'll
just start right with the first question. You can assume it's been all set up for the audience.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Do you want me in this?
No, you don't need those. You're welcome to wear them if you want to. I need headphones. Okay, that's good.
What is your full name?
Terry Gross.
And how do people refer
Terry.
To okay.
How do you like to be called on the air? I'll be reintroducing you constantly as Fred Rogers, the host of Mr. Rogers. So,
well, if you feel comfortable calling me Fred, I think that if I'm to call you Terry, that's nice.
Okay. All right. Good. We're ready to roll. Okay. If you were proposing your show, Mr. Rogers, now to public television or to a commercial network, and it had never been on before, it hadn't had the history that it does, do you think that they would buy it and put it on? With television the way it's changed?
Yes. I'm not sure. I think if I were the person making the choice, I certainly would put it on, because I know all that's behind the neighborhood. A lot of our philosophy doesn't show on the air. But it's there. I've worked with children and studied family life for many, many years, and I would hope that the programs that people would choose to put on the air would be ones that were really thoughtfully conceived and worked out.
Children's programs in the past few years have gotten so highly edited where everything is really quick moving and lasts about 30 seconds or a minute. Has there ever been any pressure on you to do that kind of thing, the Sesame Street kind of thing, where there's just a lot of action and animation and scenery changes and all that real quickly?
No, there hasn't been pressure. I think it's simply because people have felt you shouldn't tamper with something that children seem to relate to. I do know that very early on, I was called to New York one time to possibly replace somebody who wasn't going to sign his contract at one of the networks. And the meeting was with the executives, who began by saying to me, "Now, what costume will you wear?" And I said, "Well, I would do just what I've always done." And they said, "Oh, well, you've got to have a costume, and maybe we should have a clown with you." And I said, "I really think I'm in the wrong office." And so there wasn't any more talk about that. But I think what's unique about our program is that I give myself. And most of the people on the program are just themselves. I've never considered myself an actor, Terry. And I think that children respond to that kind of honesty.
Well, sometimes when I'm listening to your record or the show, I'm doing it alone. I don't have children, but I find something very reassuring about it, and I feel like you're speaking really directly. And I think talking to children is one of the most difficult things to do, because it's so easy to be patronizing and talk down to them as if they're inferior and stupid, but need to be entertained by the grown-ups. How did you find your voice? I mean, I know it's not acting, and I know it's something that comes really natural, but how did you develop such an easy and genuine presence around children and know how to speak with them so that it wouldn't be patronizing?
I think it must have started when I was born, because I have always seemed to learn so much from children. I could never feel that I would be patronizing to such wonderful teachers that I have had. I guess my ears are pretty big. And I love to listen and try to find what the tone of a situation is. And I'm always asking the question why, because I really feel that there is always a reason for behavior.
One of the things that you always do on your show is, you know, when you come in, you change into a cardigan and put on your sneakers. How did you develop that? It's become such a trademark of your program.
I think that it just came so naturally by my wanting to be comfortable myself that it's turned out that children seem to find that routine comfortable. I know many people have written to tell us that their children love to put on a sweater and sneakers when they hear the music of the neighborhood coming and sit down. And our program is one in which children seem to be able to be attentive to it for long periods of time. I've heard of very young children watching for a long time. In fact, some of our research shows some very interesting things, and that is that the younger the child, the more interested they are in the program when my face is on the screen. The older the child, they're more interested when there is the neighborhood of make-believe and the different puppets. But it leads me to believe that the younger children might consider the television screen as another mother's face. I think of the mother's face at feeding the infant as the map of the world. And if this is true, if there's something within us that thinks of the television screen as analogous to that early time with mother or with dad, that intimate time, think how important what appears on the television screen is. You've seen people watching television and drinking a soft drink and eating popcorn and filling their mouths like a feeding experience. I'm sure you've seen that. I've seen it a lot. And I just wonder if that could be an analogy.
What do you think about television and children? A lot of parents don't want their kids to watch TV. And I know you're really sensitive about how media affects children. You do a TV show that's, I think, unlike any others. Do you think that television is necessarily good or necessarily bad for kids?
I think that a lot of it has to do with what the child is bringing to the television experience, that the drama within that child is going to determine how he or she will see a certain thing. So many people have talked about our work with such a simple thing as helping children understand that they can't go down the bathtub drain. And you know I sing that song, "You can never go down, can never go down, can never go down the drain." Well, if a child is very concerned about the loud rush of the flush of either the bathtub or the toilet and comes to the neighborhood on a day when I am talking about that, that will be highly dramatic for that child. That child will focus in on what I'm talking about and showing much more than if there were some very loud cartoon or all kinds of fancy production going on. And for instance, if you were thinking of adopting a child and there were a whole array of programs on a certain evening, and one of them had to do with adoption, you would probably choose that one. And so it's the inner drama of the viewer and the listener that means so much in communication. You know, who's listening to us right now? What are their concerns? What are they worried about? What gives them joy? I'd love to know, because I think that radio and television and these things are very personal media. And the reason that I have worked all these years with children and with parents is that I want to know at least the general things that people are concerned about, so that I can speak to them and dramatize them as creatively as I know how.
Well, yeah, well, something that you really do is talk about what kids are scared of instead of just doing the clown bit, you know, having a clown is going to entertain them. You talk about things that frighten them. You'll even say to kids, you know, like, you and I, we're friends, we can talk. What scares you?
Mm-hmm.
Why do you focus on that? Because like a lot of your songs and sometimes on the show too, it's about what's making kids nervous. It's not an attempt to just like entertain them and make them laugh, you know.
I'd like them to know that there are things inside them that are okay to talk about, and they might feel anxious about them, and I feel that somebody needs to tell them that it's all right to talk about what they're scared of, what makes them angry, what makes them sad, what makes them happy. They should know that there is a full array of emotions in life, and all of them are fine. It's what we do with them that matters. And I like to think that the neighborhood is a kind of smorgasbord of ways to deal with how we feel. For me, it was always music and puppets. That's the way I dealt with how I felt. For others, it might be dance or welding or building with blocks. I could go on for a half an hour about all of the ways that we offer kids. We show them so many ways of healthy sublimation that I like to think that is a major part of what we do.
I want to play one of your records where you're singing a song, and the song is called Sometimes People Are Good. And then it follows up that sometimes people are bad, and that the people who you really care about, when they're bad to you, that's what really hurts the most. Can you tell us about like the writing of this song and how you try to have like music and lyrics reach the children who you're singing to?
Yes. Well, of course, you know my first work was in music composition at Rollins College, and that I started writing songs when I was 5 years old and just kept going. And, of course, we had classical training at Rollins, but I loved to write music, and particular songs that have what I consider a child development kind of message. And sometimes people are good is a song that speaks to a very important growth task in childhood. And that is that at the beginning, children think that a person is either good or bad. And it's very difficult for them to see any negative behavior in the person that they have considered good, and any positive behavior in the person that they've considered bad. But it's essential to their growth that they know that everybody is good sometimes and everybody is bad sometimes, because they can then realize that they can be both too. Otherwise, they would have to label themselves bad, because they know very well that they do things that are contrary to what they should. Well, that was the basis of Sometimes People Are Good, and they do just what they should. But the very same people who are good sometimes are the very same people who are bad sometimes. And the song says, it's funny, but it's true. Well, what it really is, it's comfortable, and it's true.
Well, let's hear you singing that from one of your albums. And my guest, if you're just joining us, is Fred Rogers, also known as Mr. Rogers, which is the name of the program that he's hosted. And let's listen to that recording.
Sometimes people are good, and they do just what they should. But the very same people who are good sometimes are the very same people who are bad sometimes. It's funny, but it's true. It's the same, isn't it, for me? And sometimes people get wet, and their parents get upset. But the very same people who are wet sometimes are the very same people who are dry sometimes. It's funny, but it's true. It's the same, isn't it, for me? And sometimes people make noise, and they break each other's toys. But the very same people who are noisy sometimes are the very same people who are quiet sometimes. It's funny, but it's true. It's the same, isn't it, for me? And sometimes people get mad, and they feel like being bad. But the very same people who are mad sometimes are the very same people who are glad sometimes. It's funny, but it's true. It's the same, isn't it, for me? And sometimes people are good, and they do just what they should. But the very same people who are good sometimes are the very same people who are bad sometimes. It's funny, but it's true. It's the same, isn't it, for me? Isn't it the same for you?
Fred Rogers singing one of his own songs from his program, Mr. Rogers, Sometimes People Are Good. Have you ever thought of like recording an album of jazz or pop standards with a jazz trio?
No, I haven't, but I've thought how great it would be if somebody who is known for that would sing some of our songs. And as I listen to that song, and I must confess I haven't heard our records for quite a while, I thought that's one way to help people be compassionate, is to help them not be so hard on themselves. That just struck me as I listened to that song, and I'm very grateful. I'm very grateful for that. Because we see other people through our own eyes, and if we're very demeaning and mean to ourselves, it's fairly natural that our eyes will see other people in such a narrow way. So I would hope that children could, you know, it sounds so simple. Sometimes people are good and sometimes people are bad, and I would think that there would be people who would write that off as a silly child song. But if they could look deeply within themselves and be able to accept that message. I don't know, I didn't expect to be moved by a song that was on one of our records.
Did you ever want to be a nightclub singer or anything?
Oh, no. No, the closest thing that we've ever done to singing in public is singing with orchestras, several orchestras throughout the country. We and children and their parents have come to what they call Mr. Rogers concerts. And one of the most touching moments in the concert is when I teach the children to sing a little song called Tree, Tree, Tree. And it's a very simple song that that my son and I made up before he went to bed at night. And we would sing it before he would go to sleep. And he used to love the word tree. And so he knew that I wrote songs. And I said, "You want to write a song?" And he said, "Sure." And so he just sang, "Tree, tree, 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 tree. We love you, yes we do, yes we do, we love you." And that's it. But to hear thousands of children singing this little song is like having a great big hug. And I know when Daniel Tiger comes to one of those concerts and is very shy, and the children whisper to him to help him over his shyness, he often says, "I'd really like a hug." And the children just reach out their arms from their seats in the hall and give a pretend hug to a little tiger who is no larger than 12 inches high.
Can we talk about your childhood a little bit?
Sure.
Were you shy as a child?
I think so. I was an only child. I had to make up a lot of my friends myself, and I think that was the beginning of the whole neighborhood of make-believe. I had a very rich fantasy life.
What were the friends that you had imagined?
I didn't imagine them. I had puppets, and so I would play with the puppets, and I can't remember their exact forms, but I knew that they were important to me. I think that all of the puppets in the neighborhood of make-believe are facets of who I am.
Were your parents ever worried that you had this imaginary life? Did they ever think it was a manifestation of a disturbance instead of just, you know, healthy imaginary behavior?
If they were, they didn't communicate it to me. I think that my mother particularly was interested in the theater. And my dad loved music. I don't think that they made me feel strange about that. In fact, my nephew, I was an only child until I was 11, and then my sister came, and she has two sons, and one of her sons is studying piano now in college. And we feel very good about that. And so the arts in our family, I think we're always supported.
Was there somebody in your life who was the kind of figure for you, like you've become to so many children, who would, you know, like reassure you and, you know, want to discuss things with you? Of course, you can't actually step out of the TV and discuss it with all the kids, but you offer that to them. Was there someone like that for you?
I guess the closest person was my grandfather, Mr. McFeely. And, of course, we've named the Speedy Delivery Man for him. We called him Ding Dong because he taught us that childhood rhyme, Ding Dong Bell, Pussy in the Well. And everybody called him Ding Dong. He was the kind of person who would really support your strivings for autonomy. And while my parents and my grandmother were naturally very concerned about my health and hazards around, he was the kind of person who, when I would walk on one of his stone walls, for instance, and they would say, "Better get down." Ding Dong would say, "Ah, let the kid walk on the wall. He's got to learn to do things for himself." And that's so helpful to know that there are limits, but there are people who would help you to stretch beyond some of those limits.
What were the things that really scared you when you were a child?
I think the most scary thing was being alone and thinking that maybe nobody would come to get me. And I think that school, beginning school, was tough for me. That's probably why I've done so much work for children in this area. I think also I was frightened of the doctor, and that's probably why I've made all those videotapes about helping children know about what hospitalization is like before they go. Probably why I wrote that song, I Like to Be Told, because I did. I liked to be told about things before I had to go do them. You know, as we were driving here to meet you, I wanted to talk with the people in the car about who you were and what you were like. I wonder if we all aren't like that. Don't most people like to be prepared internally for what might be new? I like to think that the neighborhood does that.
You said that you were uncomfortable about going to the doctors, as I'm sure most kids are. Were you a healthy child, though? Did you have to go to the doctor more often than other kids you knew did?
I was healthy except for allergies. And I remember going to camp one time, and I had to take the hay fever stuff with me, and the nurse at the camp called me her best pincushion because they would give me so many shots for hay. Thank the Lord, I don't have hay fever anymore. You know, after I was 40, somehow that went away. But that can be a real tough thing for a kid.
Did you like scary movies or books?
I can't remember.
Did you go to the movies a lot?
I would go to the movies, and then I would come home and I would play the songs on the piano. I would pick out the songs on the piano that I heard at the movies. Yeah, it's hard for me to remember. I remember a couple movies that I liked. Shirley Temple. And I liked those kinds of stories that, she would always come out okay at the end. And I met Shirley Temple Black not too long ago, and I just sat beside her in awe. And I said, it was interesting because the first thing I said to her was, you were one of my favorite people. She said, were. That was the first thing she said. And that really put me back. I expected her to say something about, I'm really glad that I could have been part of your childhood. But all she said was, were. I was one of your favorite people. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, it is. So did she diminish in your esteem after saying that?
A little bit. But I think that so many people you put on pedestals when you see them from afar. And it's probably just not fair to expect them to be as wonderful as you thought they would be when you met them.
Did you have other heroes or heroines when you were young from the media or movies? Or?
Oh, sure. I guess the biggest one was Johnny Weissmuller.
Really?
Yeah. I swim every day.
Really?
And I wonder if there isn't some tie with that. It just dawned on me. But I swim every morning at around 7 o'clock and then go to work.
What attracted you about Tarzan? Or Johnny Weissmuller?
Yeah. Oh, that would be wonderful to be out in the woods like that and swing from those things. That's a lot of freedom.
What about when you were a teenager? Was that an uncomfortable experience, or did you feel like you fit in with everybody in high school, which is, I think, a pretty traumatic time for a lot of people when they're growing up?
It sure is. I think that teenage years are probably uncomfortable for everybody. It's just that some seem to be able to carry it off with more elan than others. But it was tough for me at the beginning. And then I made a couple friends who found out that the core of me was okay. And one of them was the president or the head of the football team. He later became my best friend in high school. And we've carried on that friendship for a long, long time. But it was after the beginning of that friendship that I was more accepted in school. Then I became the editor of the yearbook and finally the president of the student council by the end of high school. But I was a very shy person going into high school.
What did you think you were going to be when you got out of school and started a professional career?
I thought I was going to be a diplomat and was thinking about going to a school for diplomacy. And then I changed my mind, and this was during college. I wanted to be a minister and was all set to go to seminary after college. But I saw this thing called television, and I saw people throwing pies in each other's faces and all kinds of demeaning behavior. And I thought, I would really like to try my hand at that and see what I could do. And so instead of going to the seminary after graduation, I got a job at NBC in New York and went there for 2 years before joining educational television.
Well, you worked on The Hit Parade and the Kate Smith Hour, I think.
Mm-hmm, The Voice of Firestone and all of those programs.
What were the codes that you were taught then, you know, about what you can do and what you can't do on television?
It was so young, Terry, that we were developing our own codes. Those production meetings were wonderful because everybody's ideas were entertained. And I enjoyed meeting the people that I worked with, and I felt good about those years, particularly the NBC Opera Theater. Working with those people was a magnificent experience. I'll never forget the time when we started A Mall in the Night Visitors. Menotti was commissioned by NBC to write that opera for television, and we did the first production of it. And Toscanini was still alive then, you know. He was the conductor of the NBC Symphony, and he came to the dress rehearsal. And when the rehearsal was over, he was in tears, and he went over to Giancarlo and hugged him and said, "This is the finest you've done so far, my son." It was fun. It's like, this is fun, Terry. This is live. And it was fun to know that you were putting something over the air for people to accept with whatever flaws there were.
It surprises me, I think, that since things were going well and you liked the programs that you were able to work on, that you left for a fledgling station, a brand new station in educational television, which was also new. It sounds like it was very risky to do that. Why did you make that switch?
I don't know. Pittsburgh was closer to where I grew up. Maybe I wanted to. I had just gotten married in New York, and maybe I had wanted to go back. I'm not sure that's so. I think that it had to do with wanting to work with children, because every day that I had off at NBC, I would go and visit a daycare center or an orphanage or a hospital that cared for children. And I cannot tell you why. I'm sure it had very deep roots. But when I got to Pittsburgh, and there were only three or four of us working at QED then, we weren't even on the air. This was in November of 53, and we didn't go on the air until April of 54, 30 years ago. One of the secretaries and I did a children's program together because nobody else wanted to do a children's program. But we were doing all of these other things as well. Each of us had a salary of $75 a week. And out of our own pockets, we bought all of the props for the program. And we called the program the Children's Corner. And it was on an hour every day. And I expected that I would play the organ for the hostess to sing. She would introduce all of the films, which I, as the producer, would get from all over the country. They had to be free because we didn't have any budget. Well, I didn't realize it, but those films were very brittle at times. And, of course, everything was live, and we'd be on the air, and here would be a film showing, and it would break. We'd have to fill with something. And so the night before we went on the air, Mrs. Dorothy Daniel, who was the general manager of the station, gave me a little tiger puppet. So I called him Daniel for her. And when the first film broke, I just poked the puppet through, and this was just a very fanciful set with drawings on it. And I just poked him through, and it happened to be a clock where I poked him through. And he just said,
It's 5:02, and Columbus discovered America in 1492.
And that was the first thing that I ever said through puppetry on the air.
Wow, that's great. Were you like just discovered then? Did they realize that you were really good and should have more time to do it?
Well, we had an hour every day. And
it was your show as much as anybody else's, right?
Yes, it was up to us with what we would do with it. But I just wanted you to know that necessity there was the mother of that invention, because it hadn't been planned. And so much that is spontaneous is what can be truly inspired. And I feel that all that I've done that's been really helpful and good has been inspired.
You went back to the seminary after doing children's programming for a while, right?
Well, I started with the station, and after we got that children's program going, it got to be so busy for us that the secretary and I both gave up all of our other duties to do the children's corner. As it got moving, the second year, I decided I would go to the seminary, so I went on my lunch hour and took courses just one at a time, never expecting that I would get and graduate. It took me 8 years, and I finally graduated and was ordained a minister in the Presbyterian Church.
What was different about you after you were ordained? You know, did you change your life in any way, or did it change the way you did the show?
I don't think so. I think that it just constantly confirmed what I always believed, and that was that we can be present to the moment, and we can be inspired by what's best in the universe.
Obviously, you're very religious, but I don't think you... It's not a religious program that you do. I mean, it's not a denominational program, and I'm sure that's intentional on your part.
It's far from denominational and far from overtly religious. The last thing in the world that I would want to do would be something that's exclusive. I would hate to think that a child would feel excluded from the neighborhood by something that I said and did.
How did being a father change the way you did the program? Because you started the program before you had children.
Started the children's corner, yes, before I had children. But our children were 3 and 1 when we started the neighborhood. And, of course, that started in Canada. After I graduated from the seminary, I thought that I was going to do a program for the Presbyterian Church. And I was all set to do it on graduation. And the day before graduation, I found out that the money was not forthcoming to make the program. The day after graduation, I had a call from Dr. Frederick Rainsbury in Toronto, who was then head of children's programming for the CBC. He said, "Fred, I would like you to do a program for our network." I said, "You can't imagine what a voice from heaven you are to me right now," because I really didn't know what I was going to do. I could have accepted a parish ministry job, but I felt that this was a ministry in itself. So I went to Canada, took Joanne and the two boys, and we lived there for over a year. And I did a daily program. I thought I was going to do puppets and music, as I had always done for those 8 previous years. But Fred said to me, "I have seen you talk with children, and I'd like you to translate that to the television screen." There are always a few people in this life who think that you can do more than you think you can do. And he was one of them. He trusted me so much that I began to think, well, maybe I can. And so we did.
Did it work right away?
Somehow it did. Oh, They were very sorry when I decided to come back to the United States. I decided that I wanted to raise the boys here. And so we came back, and they said, "Well, what are we going to do? Because you've built such an audience in this time." And I said, "Well, why don't you build something around my assistant puppeteer who came from Pittsburgh with me? His name was Ernie Coombs." And so they said, "Well, let's work something out." And so we did. Ernie Coombs has been there ever since with a very, very popular children's program called Mr. Dress Up.
I've seen it on my visits to Canada.
Well, that's Ernie, and he and I started out together at WQED in Pittsburgh.
Wow. I'm speaking with Fred Rogers, if you're just joining us. I think a lot of people who start in children's programming see it as just a stepping stone along the way to adult programming. Did people ever expect you to, like, once you made a name for yourself, leave the kids and you know, graduate, in quotes, to adult shows?
I don't know whether they expected it, but I wanted to talk with adults as well as children. And that's why we started the series Old Friends, New Friends. And we did about 20 of those interview programs all over the country. And I liked them. I liked talking with adults. I liked, most of all, listening to their stories. And what I think you like that, too. I kind of sense that you do.
Yes.
Because all the time that we've been talking here, you've been looking at me. And you haven't been distracted by other things, and I think you're interested in other people. Well, I certainly am. It would be fun when we're finished with this if I could just interview you and know more and more about you. But people like Lee Strasberg, who talked with me, for instance, about his father, and told me, and the tears were coming down his face. He said, "You know, I hadn't thought of this before." And that's the kind of wonderful thing that can happen when you can visit somebody for a day or two and they don't have to be concerned with the camera. And those programs and the programs that we have developed for parents, speaking about special issues like going to school or concern about discipline, and lots of things that we've done, those parent specials. I've liked that, but I haven't considered the children's program a stepping stone. That's always been my base. That's home base for me. Well, oh, yeah, I like to go out to first, second, and third base once in a while for other audiences, but it's always been focused on families with young children.
You're celebrating your 30th anniversary now with Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood.
Yes.
And it strikes me that many people now do what they're doing for like a year or 2 years, and then it's expected that you should you should progress, you should climb the ladder in whatever your profession is and go on. Do you feel like you've been going against the current by sticking with that one show, which isn't to say you haven't done, I mean, you've done dozens of other programs in addition to that, and you've written books and written songs. You're not just doing that program, but you've stayed with it. You haven't given it up. Because it seems to me that that really is kind of going against the current.
Well, I think if you want to have a really deep relationship with somebody, you stay with it. And I have wanted through the years to have a really significant relationship with the young children who have used our work. And now, parents are writing to me to say, I grew up with the neighborhood, and now I'm giving it to my own children. And that means more to me than you could know right now. But someday you'll know that, because someday you will have talked with people long enough through radio that they'll write to you and say, hey, you're still doing it. Thanks for sticking with us.
Some people are scared when they hear that because all they can think of is like, God, I must be really old now if the people who started hearing me have children of their own.
Well, how can you grow unless you've had time to grow? And I feel that all through the years I've had wonderful chances to grow. I'm very grateful to public broadcasting. I really am, because what other network would have given those of us who began so early such a long opportunity to grow in that field?
I think like performers and broadcasters are always really grateful to their audiences for liking what it is they do and enabling them to keep doing it. Do you feel like grateful to the children who who have been just so enthralled with you for so many years, and it's constantly a new generation of children who you're talking to?
Well, if it weren't for them, I wouldn't be able to do what I do. In fact, if it weren't for the children who watch, I wouldn't be Mr. Rogers. Just like if it weren't for the children that a teacher teaches, that teacher wouldn't be a teacher. A firstborn child in a family makes a husband and wife a father and mother.
I want to thank you very, very much for talking with us about yourself and about the program, and I hope that you continue to do it for many more years. It's a very special show, and I want to thank you for being here.
Thank you, Terry, and I wish you well in all that you do.
Thanks. Let's listen to a couple of more of the songs that you've recorded. Do you want to say anything about them? We're going to be hearing You're My Special Friend, and after that, we're going to hear, what did I choose for after that?
Children Can?
Yeah. Do you want to say anything about it, about writing it?
Well, sometimes people let children know through either words or inference that it's that you're going to be important only when you grow up, that childhood is just a springboard for what is valuable. Well, Children Can is a song that speaks to what children can do that after a while adults can't do. And of course, I constantly want people to know that they're valuable no matter what their age, climb, position. So that's what Children Can is all about. And of course, You Are My Friend, You Are Special is a song that I hope people feel special about.
Can I just ask you one more thing before we go? You know how a lot of adults always say, God, I wish I was a child again. Do you ever wish you were 5 or 10 or 12?
Yes, but I'd like to be that with what I know now. And I think that I'd like that because there are a good many significant people in my life that I have lost through death. and I'd like to be able to talk with them again and tell them some things that I wasn't able to tell them then. In fact, I'd like to be able to tell them you are special.
Okay, thanks for talking with us, and we'll hear a couple of Fred Rogers songs now.
You are my friend, you are special. You are my friend, you're special to me. You are the only one like you my friend. I like you in the daytime, in the nighttime, any time that you feel's the right time for a friendship with me, you see. F-R-I-E-N-D, special, you are my friend, you're special to me. There's only one in this wonderful world. You are special in the daytime, in the nighttime, any time that you feel's the right time for a friendship with me, you see. F-R-I-E-N-D, special, you are my friend, you're special to me. There's only one in this wonderful world. You are special. You really are special to me. Do you know why? Well, you see, I'm a man who likes to talk and sing with children. So I need someone like you who likes to listen to a man like me. After all, it's you who make your mom a mother, and it's you who make your dad a father, and it's really you who make me your special friend. I need you. See why you're so special to me? And you know, you can do many things that grown-ups can't do anymore. For one thing, you can pretend you're all grown up. And then when you've finished pretending, you can be just the way you are. Only children can do that. Oh, there are lots of things children can do. Who can crawl under a table? Who can sit under a chair? Who can fit their feet in little shoes and sleep most anywhere? Who can play very much longer, play much harder than grown-ups ever dare? You're a child, so you can do it. You can do it everywhere. Who can wake up every morning and be ready right away? Who can notice all the tiny things that other people say? Who can make the things they play with something different for every single day? You're a child, and you can do it. You can do it anyway. Roll in the grass, squish in the mud, lick an ice cream cone, sing to a bass, splash in a flood, by a stepping stone, all alone. Who can put your hand in my hand and be ready to feel all safe and strong? You're a child, so you can do it. Children do it
all life long.